Well, good evening. If you'll turn over to 1 Samuel, get things started here. First Samuel, we're going to be in chapter 17. So we're not going to do a whole lot of turning tonight, so we're mostly going to be in chapter 17. But what that means, though, is that you can't fall asleep, since there's not a lot of turning. So I didn't do a lot of turning, and that means you have to, like, you know, I had to do something, you got to do something, right? So, all right, so 1 Samuel 17. We're just going to read a little bit just to kind of get us started. We're actually going to be looking at this at pretty much the entire chapter for the most part, about two-thirds of it. And so we'll pick up a lot of context as we go from there. So let's go ahead and we'll start in verse 1. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle, and were gathered together at Shochoh, which belongeth to Judah, and pitched between Shochoh and Azekah in Ephrathah Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah, and set the battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And he had an helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. And he had greaves of brass upon his legs, and a target of brass between his shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. And his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him. And he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel, and said unto them, Why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine, and ye servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. And the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." We'll stop there for now. We'll pick up the rest of it as we go. Let's see. Brother Hubbard, if you please open us up in prayer.
Father, as we
Amen. You may be seated. All right. So what we're going to really be looking at tonight is we're going to be looking at fear and faith. We'll kind of get into it a little bit more, but what really kind of brought me to this passage, I had come across it as I was doing some reading in my Bible, and this was prior to Pastor asking me to preach. And then as I kind of was just thinking about it, and then as I was just kind of listening and kind of watching the world around us, and with the election coming up and all of these sorts of things, and it just kind of impressed me that the culture that we're living in and the time that we're living in, that many people live in an attitude of fear, and they see everything as a giant. And so we're just going to kind of talk about that tonight. We're going to talk about some of the things that led up to this interaction between David and Goliath, and just pull hopefully some practical things out of this tonight. So we're just going to start working in verse 1, work our way up through it, and just see how far we can get with this here tonight. First thing that as we look at verse 1, we see it says, "Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle, and were gathered together at Shochoh, which belongeth to Judah, and pitched between Shochoh and Azekah and Ephes Damon." What I want you to notice in this verse is that it says, "which belongeth to Judah." See, the giants want to take the ground that belonged to God. And the enemy is never satisfied with any ground that they have. It doesn't matter what the situation is. If you're looking at, in a wartime situation, regardless of what that situation is, think about it maybe as a like on a football field or something like that. No one's satisfied with being at the 40-yard line, right? They want to take some more ground. And the enemy is never going to be satisfied with the ground that they have. The enemy always wants more. And the enemy won't be satisfied with just taking ground in our lives. So if you're a parent here tonight, the enemy's not going to be satisfied to just take ground in your life. If you're a husband here tonight, the enemy's not going to be satisfied with taking ground in your life. The enemy's going to want to take some ground in your wife's life. And then extend that down to your children. If you have grandchildren that are present in your lives, the enemy is going to, no matter what, the enemy is going to want to take and take and take and take, and the enemy is never satisfied. We see in verse 2, as we move on through, it says, "And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines." Oh, just as, I don't know if I already said this, but so there's going to be a lot of kind of just context and build up, and then we'll have 3 points at the end. So when we actually get down to the points, you'll know, like, oh, we're getting close to the end. All right. So, moving on. Verse 2, it tells us that Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines. Now, the valley of Elah was significant because it would give the Philistines a backdoor entrance to the hill country by way of Bethlehem. So they had to be stopped. This wasn't something that Israel could just turn their back on. They couldn't ignore the fact that there were giants trying to take the valley. There was actually 5 valleys. They were called the valleys of Shephelah. And they provided passage from the Philistine plains to the hill country. And so defending them was a constant necessity in the life of the country of Israel. And it's been said that the extent to which Israel controlled those 5 passageways, it was an accurate barometer as to the extent to which their strength was at that time. So you could look at how well they were managing the valleys of Shephelah, and you could say, oh, okay, if Israel is only managing a couple of them, and yeah, they're pretty weak right now. The same could be said about our spiritual strength when we examine the extent to which the valleys in our lives are controlled by our enemies. You got to be careful drawing correlations in the Bible, because sometimes you can take them too far. But there happens to be 5 valleys of Shephelah. We happen to have 5 senses, right? So I just thought that was interesting. And while it's not our message, I think you'd agree with me that when we're strong spiritually, our senses are more in tune with spiritual things. When we're strong spiritually, the things that we point our eyes to will be spiritually minded. And when we're strong spiritually, the things that we listen to will be more spiritually minded. The things that we put our hands to, our feelings, our emotions, all of those things, we're going to act and we react differently when the enemy has free rein in what we see, in what we hear, in what we do, what we put our hands to. So just in that same vein, it was very important that Israel maintained control of this valley. Now moving on into verse 3, we see, it says, "And the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other, and there was a valley between them." And we read about Goliath as he comes out, and if you were to see Goliath in person, he was an impressive guy. I mean, let's look at just a couple things about him. In verse 4, we see that he was about 9 feet tall. That's a big guy. I mean, I'm 5'5", so most people are big to me. But 9 feet tall, that would basically be somebody that's about twice my size. I've never encountered anybody that was quite that tall. And so not only was he 9 feet tall, just his coat of mail weighed about 156 pounds. And I asked Trenton earlier before church how much he weighed, and he doesn't weigh that much. So just his coat of mail weighed more than Trenton does. His spear, just the head of his spear, weighed around 15 pounds. And it's estimated by some that overall that he as his person, He weighed around 600 pounds. So speaking as a man speaks, you would say he definitely had a command presence, right? If a 9 foot tall guy weighing 600 pounds decides to go toe to toe with you, that's going to get your attention. Which I'm sure is why he was afforded that opportunity by the Philistines. I mean, if you've got a 9 foot tall guy who's 600 pounds, who else are you going to send to the front of the battle to make your case, right? So he was an impressive guy, and we can give him that. And we look into verse 8. In verse 8 it says, "And he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, Why are you come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine and ye servants to Saul? Choose a man for you and let him come down to me." In verse 8 we see that that Goliath, he's trying to get into their head. And the enemy is always going to try to get into your head. And giants will always try to make you feel small if you listen to them. You see, while it's true that sometimes when the enemy shouts, his greatest success doesn't come through how loud he is. Many times the enemy's greatest success is in the quietness of his subtlety, right? If we were to look back and take the time to go back to Genesis, and we go back to when Adam and Eve were tempted by the serpent, how loud can a serpent be, right? The serpent didn't proclaim from the mountaintop, didn't bellow out things against God. The serpent just simply whispered a thought. "Yea, hath God said?" And sometimes that's all it takes. Sometimes you don't have to have a 9 foot tall giant shouting out accusations against you or calling you out. Sometimes just the little whispers of the enemy is enough to take us off our game. And the thing about it is that the enemy is a liar. We look in verse 9, it says, "If he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then will we be your servants." Answer me this. Do you really think that that the rest of the Philistines would just voluntarily have handed over their weapons and just given up just because Goliath was dead? If things had not played out the way they were, if it wasn't David, if just some random soldier had gone out, killed Goliath, do you think that everyone else would have just laid down their weapons? No. I don't think he would have. See, the enemy likes to make claims and make promises that never hold up. You see, if we let giants win in our lives, you can bet that you will become a servant to sin. Look over to Romans chapter 6. Just a little bit of turning here. Romans chapter 6 and verse 6. It says, "Knowing this, that our old man is crucified him, that the body of sin might be destroyed, that henceforth we should not serve sin." You see, it's never God's plan for us to serve sin. It's never God's plan for us to serve the enemy. But that's what the enemy wants for us. We see right here, at the end of verse 9, he says, and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. That's what the enemy wants. The enemy wants to enslave the people of God. The enemy wants the people of God to be doing his bidding. Doing those things that support anything that's contrary to the cause of Christ. So the enemy is a liar that seeks to enslave. We also see that the enemy is always adversarial. Look in verse 10 as we move along in our text. In verse 10 it says, "And the Philistines said, I defy the armies of Israel this day, give me a man that we may fight together." Consider the days that we live in right now. Have you ever seen such a prevailing adversarial spirit all around you? I'm not particularly old, but I'm also not exceptionally young. I'm 47 years old. But I don't recall in my lifetime just the sheer presence of this adversarial attitude everywhere you go. If you turn on the TV, and watch the news, which I don't necessarily recommend. But if you happen to turn on the TV, it's just adversarial, adversarial, adversarial about everything. You go into the workplace is adversarial. The freeway is adversarial. You guys know the kind of car that I drive. I was on my way home today. I had to go pick up our cat at the vet. And I was on my way home and this guy came up behind me and he was weaving around behind me. And I turned to go into where my house was and happened to have my window down. And he started yelling at me and all this stuff because he thought I was somebody that I wasn't. And I thought, man, this guy doesn't even know me. You know, but he was ready to throw down with me just because of who he thought that I was. You know, and we just see that all the time. Heaven forbid you get on social media. Would you say social media is an adversarial place? Absolutely. And so we're just surrounded by this spirit of this adversarial spirit. And the enemy loves that, loves to foster that. The enemy loves to promote that. 1 Peter 5:8, the devil is described as our adversary, as a roaring lion, walking about, seeking whom he may devour. And have you noticed also that the thing that invokes the greatest adversarial response are the things of God? See, Goliath stood defiant against the principles of God, against the people of God, and against God himself. And he was looking for a fight. I don't think it was just about the valley there, right? Because had it been just about the valley, then he would not have gone so far as to say, I defy the armies of the living God. He would have just said, I defy your army, right? The enemy, Goliath here, made a point of pointing out that his defiance wasn't just against them as an army. His defiance was against them as a people. His defiance was against them on principle and on everything that they stood for and on everything that God stands for. And that's that adversarial spirit that we see about us today. So Goliath, he stood defiance against these things and he was looking for a fight. The principalities and powers that rule this world and those who embrace their methodologies, they go crazy when God, his principles and his practices are lifted up as an example of how people should live. Just try it sometime. If you come across somebody, you're dealing with somebody and they say, oh, I've got this problem in my life. And you give them a solution from the Bible. They will lose their mind a lot of times. And especially in a work environment, they will really have a problem with that. So the enemy is looking for a fight. The enemy is adversarial by nature, and he's always looking for a fight. Moving on to verse 11, says, when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. See, unfortunately, Saul and the people of Israel listened to his rhetoric. The word heard in verse 11, it says, when Saul and all Israel heard those words, that word heard there doesn't just mean to overhear something. It doesn't just mean that I hear something in the distance, that I hear something ambient in the air. That's not what that word means. It has the connotation of listening to with comprehension, believing what has been said. We, and in particular our youth, are bombarded daily and constantly with the world's rhetoric. And we need to be careful what we hear and what we listen to and what we believe. This, I think, is one of the greatest dangers and issues with social media as a whole, is because, and this is not just young people, because everywhere I go, and I'm guilty of it myself sometimes, you look around and this is what you see. I mean, you go to a waiting room, to a doctor's waiting room. Are people talking to each other? Nope. This is what you see. If we were to play like Pictionary and I did this, you'd be able to figure out in 2 seconds what I was, right? A guy on his cell phone, right? But social media, we're just so inundated with these concepts and these things that of the world, and we've got to be so very careful to what we listen to and what we actually believe. Yes, there's nothing that we can do about what the world is going to say around us. But we have a choice as to whether or not we choose to list to believe it, that we choose to adhere to it, that we choose to take it as truth. Because if you listen to the garbage of the world long enough, you might start believing it, even though it runs contrary to the truth of God's word. And when that happens, you will do things that you know you shouldn't, like fear. That's what happened to Saul and all Israel. And at the end of verse 11, it says they were greatly afraid. You see, this wasn't just your regular old fear. All right? The word greatly means to fear with muchness, abundance, exceedingly. See, we're not called to muchness of fear in the face of giants. No, we're called to an abundance of confidence in our God. That's what we're called to. And what we see happening here in this account with Goliath and the people of Israel is that they believed the lies and they took it to heart, and it caused them great fear. Now moving on to verses 12 through 15, we see it says, now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons, and the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle, and the names of his 3 sons that went to the battle were Eliab of the firstborn, the next of Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the 3 eldest followed Saul. But David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So we see here that Jesse had 8 sons in total. 3 of them were under the command of Saul at the battle. And we see that previously David had served Saul as a musician. If we were to look back in the previous chapter, we'd see that he had been a musician for Saul, and he had played for him and calmed him when his spirit was agitated. But now we see that the battle has come, that war has been declared, and so David has had to go back to his humble beginnings as a serving in his father's house as a shepherd. So we move on to verse 16 through 19. We see, and the Philistines drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. And Jesse said unto David, his son, take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to thy brethren, and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000, and look how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge. And so we see that this giant berated the people of Israel with his defiance of the one true and living God for 40 days. Now Bethlehem was only about 10 miles from the valley of Elah here. And so I don't know exactly how far it would take for the word to get back to Jesse's house, but probably wouldn't take very long. The average person can run about 8 miles an hour. So, you know, even on foot, it would only take you a couple hours to get to the battlefield from Bethlehem. So it wasn't really that far. And so with it only being 10 miles from the battlefield, I would imagine it wouldn't take very long for word to spread about this giant and his defiance, but even worse, Israel's fear. When the country starts hearing about how their army is standing in fear against a giant, that's not a good thing. And so I'm sure this concerned Jesse. Obviously it concerned Jesse. And so Jesse sends David to the battle with provisions for his brothers, a little something for the captain of the unit. But mainly he wanted to know how his sons were. We see that in verse 18. It says, and look how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge. So he really wanted to just understand, hey, how are your brothers doing? I hear that there's this giant that's defied the armies. I want to know if your brothers are okay. So he sends David out to do this. So that kind of, that brings us up to the three things that we're going to look at tonight. The first thing we want to see is we want to look at faith refined. Faith refined. So when we look at a faith like David's faith, an example faith, if you will, that one of the things that we can understand about it is that faith is grown in times of quiet. Faith is grown in times of quiet. If we turn over to Psalm 16. In Psalm 16, it says, we'll just look in verse 8. Let's see, verse 7 says, I will bless the Lord who hath given me counsel. My reins also instruct me in the night seasons. I have set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand. I shall not be moved. Therefore my heart is glad and my glory rejoiceth. My flesh also shall rest in hope. For thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption. Thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore. So we see that he talks here about being instructed in the night seasons. And when we consider about how our faith grows, consider for a moment an athlete, all right? Do athletes get the majority of their training on the field? Let's just use football for the sake of an example. Is it on the field where they refine their muscles and their tactics and their procedures and where they get their strength? Do they get that on the field? No, they don't. They get that in the gym, don't they? It's between the battles where that strength is grown. And the same thing is true about our faith. Our faith is grown in those times when we don't necessarily need it quite as much as other times. If you've ever done spent any amount of time in the gym or anything like that, you know that if you work a particular muscle group one day, then that next day you don't work that same muscle group again. You let it kind of build up again, and then that's how your muscles grow. They get torn down a little bit and they get built back up. And our faith is a lot like that. And praise the Lord that most people, the times when they need faith the most, they kind of ebb and flow. Right? You've got the good times, but you got the good times, and then you got some times you're like, boy, I really need a lot of faith today. And tomorrow, today's a pretty good day. Nothing crazy went on, you know, kind of coasting through the day. And it's in those times that our faith can be grown and encouraged and cultivated. And so we need to take advantage of those times of growing our faith in those quiet times. It's between the battles. Faith is also enables us to weather setbacks. If we look in verse 15 that we've already passed, but I want to point out something there. Faith enables us to weather setbacks. It says, but David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. Do you think that's where David wanted to be? I mean, there was a battle going on. And as best as I could tell from what I studied and read, David was somewhere between 15 and 18 years old at this time. He obviously wasn't old enough to go to battle, so he wasn't over 20. And so he ends up 10 miles away from the battlefront, 10 miles away from the action, 10 miles away from everything that his brothers is doing, the things that his brothers are fighting for, that the country is fighting for. But yet, we don't read about David bemoaning that, do we? We don't see him cursing God and saying, why can't I go to the battle? We don't see that. We just read that he goes and he goes back and he tends to his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So faith enabled him to weather setbacks. Faith is also matured in faithfulness in everyday things. When David was sent by Jesse to the battlefront to take these provisions and this food, he was basically on an errand run, right? He wasn't going there to do anything exceptional. When David left, do you think he had any idea that by the end of the day, he was going to be a national hero? Sure. I mean, that wasn't even probably anywhere in his mind. He was just being faithful to his father. He was doing what his father had said. His father had given him a list of things to do. He said, all right, yes, sir. Packed up his stuff, hopped in the chariot, went over there. Even ran up to the battlefield from the chariot, just like his father said to do. And our faith is the same way. Faithfulness in the everyday little things is what culminates in a faith that can weather the big things. If we can't be faithful to trust God when little things happen in our lives, then what's going to happen to us when truly significant things come into our lives? Today I got called over to the hospital to work to deal with a family who had just lost their 2-month-old. And you talk about a giant sitting in a room with a mother, a young mother, who had just lost her 2-month-old, and the father's sitting there, and the family is sitting there. They were devastated, understandably so. They were devastated. And my family has been there before. We've lost children. They weren't that old, but we've lost multiple children prior to birth. And those things will rock your world. I remember back in 2005, I lost both my parents within 3 months of each other. Those sorts of things can shatter you if your faith is not adequately prepared to handle those things. And the way that you would do that, the way that you prepare yourself to be able to handle those things that have the ability to crush us is in the little things. Is in faith, is in the mundane, what you might call the mundane day-to-day things that our Father has for us to do. You know, the grocery list, our passage here, that the grocery list of things that Jesse said, I want you to go do this, 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 and this. Those mundane things, those are the things that enable us, that strengthen us, that help us to be able to stand up to a giant. They give us the confidence to know that, hey, I was not expecting there to be a giant in my day today. But you know what? God has been faithful through all these other days and all these other ways, in all these smaller ways, that I know He will be faithful through this big thing today. Faithfulness, faith is matured in everyday things. Faith is also strengthened in personal battles. If we look in verse 33 of our text, we see it says, "And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." The top guy says, hey, hold on, David. I can appreciate your enthusiasm here, but don't you realize that you are just a young man, and this Goliath, this warrior that you're going to go up against, he has been doing this since he was your age. Do you not understand that? And Saul wholeheartedly, he just discounted David's ability to handle this giant right off the bat. But it is our faith that allows us to not take those things to heart. Because when God calls us to do things that seem impossible, it doesn't matter what men say. When Brother Teeter went up to Blue Springs, I imagine there were times when he thought, this is impossible. We're never going to get anybody to come to this church. But yet, look at where they are now. And it's those personal battles, it's those individual battles, those daily things that strengthen our faith and allow us and give us the ability to weather these things that come along in our lives. Our faith enables us to persevere where others have failed. We see in verse 38, it says, "And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put an helmet of brass upon his head. Also he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor and essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him." You see, David, he put on Saul's armor. He was prepared to fight a battle that others should have already fought and won. Do you realize that Goliath had been berating the people of Israel for 40 days now? 40 days. Somebody should have already stood up to this guy at this point. Somebody in the armies of Israel should have said, all right, enough is enough. You know, maybe a few days in, all right, fine, Goliath, we get it. You're big, you're bad, great, okay, enough. But that's not what happened. They simply kept cowering back against the same rhetoric that the enemy was pushing out against the armies of Israel. And our faith will allow us to persevere. And even after Saul had said, hold on, David, you can't do this. This is not going to work. But we see that David goes on. If we look in verse 34, it says what he said. Then David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep. And there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he rose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. I don't know if Saul didn't know that at that point, but that's pretty impressive. Saul says, hey, David, you don't understand. We're talking about battle here. Don't you understand that this is Goliath? Hold on, Saul. Let me tell you a story. See, I was out taking care of my father's sheep, and there's this bear came and this lion came. I took care of both of them. And Saul's kind of like, okay. You win. David remembered his previous successes, and his faith enabled to persevere, even though someone had told him that you can't do this. And we would do well to rehearse God's victories in our lives frequently. I'm ashamed to say that I haven't kept up with it, but many years ago, we actually, in our family, a long, long time ago, we started a book. We called it the Blessing Book or something like that. And we would just write down every time God had answered a prayer or every time God had done something, you know, incredible or something that just kind of caught our attention. And I really, you know, looking back, I really wish I'd have kept up with it, because if I were just to sit back and think about all the things that God has done in my life, it will just humble you. I mean, there was a time when the doctors told me that I would never walk properly again because of the injury that I had to my foot. I mean, there was a time when we didn't even know what we were going to do as far as money was concerned, and a member of this church gave me a vehicle, drove up to my house, said, "Here. Here's a vehicle for you because I know that you need one." That'll humble you. And when you rehearse those things in your mind about all the ways that God has provided for you, it'll help you persevere and say, you know what? Maybe I haven't been down this road before. Maybe I haven't come up against a Goliath like this before. But I came up a Goliath like that and like that and like that. His faith enabled him to humbly withstand rebuke, discouragement, and misrepresentation. If we look in verse 28, his brother accuses him. He says, "Why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle." His brother accuses him of shirking his duty, and that he's just there to watch the battle. In verse 33, Saul accused him of being too small. But his faith enabled him to humbly withstand those things and still press forward regardless. His faith enabled him to withstand human reason to do the will of God. In verse 33, which we already looked at a couple of times, Saul's assessment that he just wasn't big enough. The strength of the bear and the lion. You know, when you look at, from a human standpoint, how many people here think that you could go up against a bear and win? I'm going to put my hand down because I'm not going to stand here and have my hand raised because I don't think I could. But yet, David did that. He went up against a Goliath called a bear one time. He went up against a Goliath called a lion one time. And he won against those. And that was all against human reasoning. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that if someone told you that they did that, you'd be like, you got a video or something? Because that seems really unlikely. Because you're not that big a guy, but yet you took out a bear? His faith enabled him to speak up bravely when no one else would. Look in verse 29. It says, and David said, What have I now done? This is in response to his brother's accusation of why he was there. He says, is there not a cause? Is there not a cause? If we look in verse 25, we see that the men of Israel, they were focused on the material gain of victory. Verse 25, it says, the men of Israel said, have ye seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel as he come up, and it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel. All they were concerned about was what's the prize for taking down Goliath. But what is David concerned with? What we see instead is that David is concerned with something very different. It says, and David spake to the men, verse 26, and David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? David was concerned with the preservation and the exaltation of the name of the one true and living God. He could care less about what the king would give him for taking down Goliath. He was concerned about who is going to stand up against this wrong. Who is going to stand up for the name of God, for the cause of Christ? And you see, it takes faith to be able to speak up. And I have a feeling that, and this has been said before from this pulpit, but I have a feeling that a time will come where it's going to take more and more faith for us to bravely speak up against the things that are wrong in this world. This world doesn't, as we've already said, doesn't take kindly to the things of God. And it's going to take faith for us to speak out. Someone needs to speak out. Because there is still a cause. Right? There has not ceased to be a cause just because the days are, because of the culture that we live in, and because it's not socially acceptable to talk about the things of God in whatever environment. That doesn't, so what? It doesn't change the fact that we have an edict to proclaim the cause of Christ, to proclaim the gospel, and to see souls saved. So faith enabled him to speak up bravely when no one else would. So we see that his faith was refined in all these things. But we need to be careful that our fear is not misaligned. In verse 26, it says this, and David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? See, David had a passion for godly things. And our fear should not be of the giants, but instead on the reproach that their presence brings to our lives. That's what we should be fearful of. We shouldn't be fearful that there are giants around us, but we should be fearful that we will allow those giants to cause our lives to be a reproach unto God, and that their influence would influence our lives, and that we would find ourselves contrary to the Word of God and contrary to the things of God. Our fear should not be in the giants themselves, but in the effects of not ridding our lives of them. You see, the strange thing about giants is that they'll return if they're not vanquished. See, giants are a lot like cancer cells. If you don't get rid of cancer cells, they'll come back. If you've ever had like termites in your house, for instance, you can't leave any behind. You got to get them all, because if you don't, they'll come back. And you see, when we go out to battle against the giants in our lives, we've got to completely get rid of them. David could have injured Goliath and taken him out of the battle and let him live. But do you think he would have come back later? Oh yeah, he would have come back. He would have come back, and he would have come back with a vengeance. Giants will return if they're not vanquished. So we have to be careful that our fear is not aligned with the giants themselves, but our fear, the thing that we should be cautious the most of, is that our lives are a representation of what God would have us to be, and that we don't have reproach in our lives. And then to finish up, let's look at some facts about giants, some truths. Giants always seem bigger than they really are. Don't remember who it was the other day. I think it might have been one of my daughters. One of my daughters was telling me about this thing that she's dealing with. And I asked her, I said, well, was this other thing that you were worried about, was it as bad as you thought it was? She said, well, no. So, well, this thing that now you're worried about now, it's not going to be as bad as you think it is. You see, we let our imagination run away with itself. And when we see a giant on the horizon, we imagine it bigger than it is. See, a lot of times we see giants kind of coming from a distance, and then we really start psyching ourselves out. And we start thinking, oh boy, when that giant gets here, this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and boy, you know, this is going to happen, and all these things. And we start psyching ourselves out before it's ever even here. How many times do we borrow trouble from tomorrow because we're concerned about a test tomorrow or a task tomorrow or a this or a whatever? Giants always seem bigger than they really are. Giants often seek to defeat us with humiliation and intimidation. If we were to look back in verse 11, it says, when Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. We've got to be so careful of what we listen to and the things that we allow our minds to recognize as truth. Turn over to James real quick. This is the biggest weapon that Goliath used in his war against the people of Israel was his mouth. And if we look in James chapter 3, and we'll just read a little bit here. It says, verse 3 says, behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold, also the ships, which though they be great and are driven of fierce winds, yet they are turned about with very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. Just those little words. I mean, if we If we, let's see, look back here, back to our text, and we look, I don't know exactly how many words Goliath actually said every time he came out, but he said a handful of words, and that handful of words stopped a standing army. Words. Goliath didn't go up against him with his spear. He just stood there and used words to stop the standing army of God's people. And we have to be careful to not, when you think about when we were growing up, you know, sticks and stones will break my bones, you know, that whole saying, right, that we always used to say. We should really listen to that a little bit more. Because just because somebody says something doesn't make it true. If it's contrary to what this book says, dismiss it. So giants often seek to defeat us with humiliation and intimidation. They're often relentless. In our passage here, we see how he came out 40 days. He was ruthless about it. We saw in verses 17 through 19 that they offer compromise, but they never intend to deliver. You know, there's an old saying, I don't know where it came from, but sin will take you farther than you want to go, and it'll leave you longer. Sin will take you farther than you want to go, it'll take more than you want to give, and it'll leave you longer than you want to stay, something along like that. I think I just murdered those lines, but something along those lines. But the point is that sin will do more damage than what we expect it to in our lives. Giants always cause the majority to flee, and often they must be fought alone. The whole army fled before Goliath, and it took the faith of one man. One man with, as we didn't get that far into it, but one man with a sling and five stones. Five stones about the size of your hand, of your palm. And the last thing is that people will often encourage us to fight giants using unproven or unbiblical methods. And this is where we'll finish off at, is that we need to be really careful that when we're developing a tactic against a giant in our life, that we take our counsel and that we take our battle plan, if you will, from the Word of God. Because if we take it from the world will say, you know, if you just do this or say this prayer or whatever, then if you just, I don't know. The world has opinions on all these different things, on how you can accomplish things in your life. You know, if you just say this prayer, you don't have to believe anything, just say this prayer and you'll be just fine. And get dunked in this water and you'll be just fine. Eat this little wafer and you'll just be fine. You know, the world has a lot of opinions on how these things can be done and how to fight these different giants. But what we notice in the life of David is that David went with what he knew. What he knew to be true. With that which he had tested himself. See, if we try to adopt the world's philosophies, we will not be successful. We cannot have victory adopting the world's philosophies. And I asked Trenton to help me with just a little illustration real quick earlier. I will tell you, this is a weighted training vest. It is not what it might look like. Can you put this on? All right.
There we go.
So Trenton, if I were to tell you, all right, I want you to go just, I know that you've got this, because you do taekwondo or something, right? All right, so, and you train for taekwondo,
yes,
right? Okay, so tomorrow, you're going to have a competition tomorrow, but I want you to do it wearing that vest. How successful will you be?
Not successful.
Why not?
It's too heavy.
You haven't proven it, right?
Okay.
Okay? That's what David said. You know, David put on all these things that Saul had given him. The world, all the things that the world had given him. You know, to use our illustration, that Saul said, hey, you know, you need this, and you need this, and you need this, and hey, I'll put on this, and carry this, and okay, this is what you need to defeat this giant. And David tried to put it on, and he kind of felt like he does right now. It's pretty heavy, isn't it? How much weight do you think's in there?
20.
Good guess. It's 20 pounds. But David knew there was no way he could be successful going up against a giant using the tactics and the ways of the world. He said, no, I'm going to go with what I know. And he went back to his roots, which is what we have to do. We have to go back to our roots. We have to go back to the Word of God. When we're unsure about how to deal with a giant in our lives, we've got to go back to the Word of God. We've always got to go back to the source, the true source of strength, if you will. All right, I'm going to get that off. All right, I'll just set this up here. The world will encourage us to fight giants using unproven or unbiblical methods. So, just to kind of finish this up. Here in a few days, where, you know, we have the election coming up, and there's a lot of fear about, you know, what's going to happen, right? But let me remind you of this, though, that regardless of the outcome of the election or the next big giant in your life, regardless of what that next giant is, if you approach that giant with the principles of God's Word and the basics, and you don't adopt the world's philosophies and the world's concerns, and we don't listen to the world, then we're going to come out on top. You know, if we were to read on through the rest of Samuel 17, we read on in verse 45, it says, and then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the name of the armies of Israel whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee, and will take thine head from thee, and will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know there is a God in Israel. Our objective should be to make sure that as much as is possible, that everyone in our world knows that there is a God, that He loves them, that He gave His life for them, and that in the midst of all the craziness that we are surrounded with, and in midst of all the fear that we're confronted with, and all the things that we're told that we need to be afraid of, we need to be pointing people to the one who can vanquish that fear. And that's God and His Word. Stand with me, if you will.